Leading Ideas Talks is brought to you by the Lewis Center for Church Leadership of Wesley Theological Seminary in Washington, D.C. Subscribe free to our weekly newsletter at www.churchleadership.com/leading ideas. Are you a pastor serving more than one congregation, or a leader in a church that's part of a multi-point ministry? In this episode, Lewis Center Director Doug Poe speaks with Small Church Vitality expert Dr. Lou Parks. They explore perspectives and practices that can help ministry flourish, even in a church that doesn't have its own pastor, or a pastor who doesn't have just one church.
Welcome to Leading Ideas Talks, a podcast featuring thought leaders and innovative practitioners. I am Douglas Poe, the director of the Lewis Center, and your host for this talk. Joining me is Dr. Lewis Parks, the professor of theology, ministry, and congregational development at Wesley Theological Seminary. His most recent book is Small on Purpose, Life in a Significant Church. Our focus for this podcast is multi-church appointments and small church ministry. But Lou, let's begin with a question. What are you reading now, or have you read recently, that is influencing your thinking on leadership?
Well, good morning, Doug. Good to be with you. And recently, I'm reading the book on providence, Thomas J. Ord, The Uncontrolling Love of God. I am interested in providence as a theological doctrine, and it's a kind of doctrine that is both personally significant, but also can be applied to small churches. So I'm always interested in both how our stories turn out, but also how the stories of congregations turn out. So always looking at that. Not especially deep, but I'm reading Why Baseball Matters by Susan Jacoby. I have been preaching series on the gospel of baseball for a few years, and do it every summer and return to it. There's a lot of lessons from baseball that apply to any church, but especially, I think, to small churches. And this particular one fascinates me because she's contrasting why people still go to baseball games in a fidgety age where their attention span is so short. What does it mean to go to a place where you sit through nine innings and the action is incredibly slow? So always looking for metaphors that can be applied to congregational life. There are a couple things I'm reading.
We'll talk a little bit later about providence, because you actually talk about that in your book. But I'm fascinated by the book on baseball, and certainly this the idea of why people go to baseball games. Can you give any more insights on how you sort of apply that to congregations in terms of why individuals would come to the church? Of course, when the purpose is not entertainment, of course, there are some churches that probably do sort of entertain, but the goal is spiritual development. And of course, some people just aren't interested in sitting for an hour to be developed in that manner. So are you finding something helpful?
Sure. That's probably going to be just one message in the series, but it's a good message for churches. You know, the issue is when you are shaped with a attention span that's just, you know, seconds or a matter of seconds, you're checking your email, you're on edge for the latest communication. How is it that you stop at this place where time is measured in different kind of way, in innings as opposed by the clock? And how do you let go in essentially a Sabbath kind of time? How do you slow down and notice things that you don't notice other times? And of course, there are people today who can't do that. You could watch a television baseball game, and you can see people sitting there with their iPhones, never looking up. But to get into the spirit of it is really to slow down and to notice things that you don't notice other times, and to have patience where success is measured in what, like 3 out of 10 times you're at bat, you don't strike out, and that's great. It's entering into a kind of playful time out of time, where you have other forms of attention, and really in a small church, that's what you have to do. I mean, you either are you either have a patience to enter into a different kind of world, where excellence is measured in a little different way, where the values of the things that you see are measured in a different way. You either have the patience to do that or you don't. And I don't want to think of the small church as a inferior version of a larger church. I want to think of it as of having its own excellence, its own valuable life. But you have to have the spirit to enter into that, and to make it work.
Well, we're going to pick up on many of those themes, but let us begin sort of talking about multi-appointments to congregations. It is becoming more common for a congregation or congregations to have a pastor that they have to share. And we often call when a pastor has more than one appointment sort of a multi-point ministry. Can you talk about some of the different or unique leadership skills needed for a pastor who has to sort of lead more than one congregation?
Sure. First, let me give some perspective on it from my point of view. I don't think it's until 1954 or so. It's incredibly late that in the whole Methodist church history, they even use the word local church. It's preaching stations. The whole mindset was that nobody was overly identified with one given congregation. Everybody was itinerant. Now, there are some systems where that translates, and there are others where there aren't. But it really is a relatively recent development in my denomination, United Methodist, and I think perhaps in some of the others, to really imagine that the norm should be a station church with its pastor. And so we have a long history then of how to think about church where you're not overly identified with a given congregation. And that's the background for what I am, so that I don't think that we have to be unduly disturbed by a development where, as you say, there are more multi-church situations. There's no doubt in my mind that one of the most significant, sociological and organizational things going on right now is the loss of station churches in many of the mainline denominations, and the return to multi-point charges, which was what the condition was before they were able to become station. So I don't see it necessarily. It does represent a loss in some ways. But in other ways, I see it as an opportunity to maybe even recapture some of the things, some of the values of the multi-church situation. What were those values? Well, number one, the pastor realized that the congregation had to have its own gifts and vitality, and the lay leadership were the most important factor in its continuance. And second, that the pastor had to be self-differentiated, that the pastor, preacher, itinerant evangelist had to be centered in himself enough that their whole identity wasn't wrapped up with what a given congregation. They were able to give of their gifts and then step back from it. And to imagine a viable career in ministry, even though you never got to serve the big cathedral church. Your whole ministry really was to the capital church and with these various corners of that church that you serve for a season. And if you start to think of it that way, then we have two things to work on. One, how to build up the vitality of that local congregation, and then how to address the mentality of the preachers who will serve them. I spend a lot of my time helping preachers who have just realized they're never going to get to serve that station church. Or they're serving churches who are disappointed that they've lost their station status, and they're trying to recover an identity, something besides waiting around till they die. And so from my point of view, there are two areas to work on. It's a new time for local congregations to realize, you know what, it never was up to the outsider who came in, whether we would make it or not, it was us. Do we have gifts of the Spirit? Do we have all the things the church is supposed to have, including gifts of leadership? And on the other hand, it's time for pastors not to be overly identified with the welfare of one congregation, but to have the kind of mindset that you want to see every congregation to flourish, within their stories, the perimeter of their stories.
And Lou, that raises a couple of questions for me. One is, if we go to the Matthew 6:24 text, where it talks about the challenge of serving two masters, and you just referenced sort of how it's sort of easy to fall in love with one church or to favor one church over the other. So how can pastors try to avoid that trap, to make sure they're not sort of favoring one church over the other church?
I think of Susanna Wesley, who said, I just love each of my children like they're the only one in the world when I'm with them. And, I love Johnny the best, and I love Charles the best when I'm with them. And I think that's what you try to convey. You do love each of your children as if they're the only one. The text about master is very clear. The option is now, which one has most of your attention. The option, your master is your Lord, and therefore you have integrity addressing both. And I think practically it gets difficult when a charge has such a differentiation in size, so that one church is providing 75% of your salary and the other side, other congregation is 25% of your salary, or the one provides the parsonage and the other has nothing to do with the parsonage. But when all said and done, basically it's, part-time pastor, full-time church. You relate to a church as each one is the full-time church. If the smaller church has three desks in a month, that's where you are. That's what you're dealing with. And I think that the kind of thing of let's divide up how much of the pastor we own is something that a pastor has to fight. That's, I am pastor to both, and I want to be there strategically for both. I want to give soul care to both. I want to be equally, I want to give my best when I preach and whatever. And resist the kind of thing that one or the other calls the shots. Now, that might mean that somebody has to do some educating when you create the charge, because a lot of charges, multiple charges, are created out of default. We're trying to make a salary package. But somebody has to explain to a person that you can't divide up a pastor by percentages that way. You might have to do that with a budget for a charge, but basically I care about each church equally as if they were, my child. On the other hand, I don't belong to each church equally. I have a self-differentiated calling before God. I want both to thrive, or three to thrive, or five to thrive.
And the other question that came to mind, Lou, is how can you, you talked about the importance of lay and lay leadership. It seems to me that it's critically important then to really work on a process of developing good lay leaders in the congregation. Do you have any thoughts or insights for how pastors at these multi-point charges can really think about a stronger discipleship process or developing lay leaders?
Well, I've served larger congregations, and where there have been some very good programs, I've used the spiritual gifts inventory in various iterations, and I've used the assets, gifts, programs of various sorts. Honestly, in a small church, it seems to me that it's one-on-one mentoring, and you come alongside somebody, you see things in them, you start to encourage them, you make sure you're there when they're in their first go at things. You accompany them, don't send them, you accompany them to training events. You get resources, like sources that I've received from the Lewis Leadership Center, and you watch it with them, or you have them look at it and you talk to them with them. I know you wouldn't do this with a larger church or a mid-sized church. You couldn't give that much time. But in a small church, the mentoring of leaders is probably the most important thing you're going to do. You're going to do your soul care because you must, but the mentoring of leaders is whether they'll go on or not. So you need to accompany them. You need to support them when they do something and do it well. You lift it up when they crash and do something wrong. You help them figure out what went wrong and what we could do better next time. And just give personal attention to that. There won't be that many, but they are the persons that will make the difference on whether the church makes or not. And the hardest thing to do as a pastor is not run in there and save them, or take it out of their hands when it's not going well. You have to pause enough for them to make mistakes and grow and that kind of thing. But I think in a small church, that personal investment, and you recognize somebody, you see things in them, you start to work with them, and you start to support them.
So one more sort of question on thinking about multi-point charges. And you talked about values. Are there sort of one or two sort of practices or insights for pastors who are maybe starting sort of a multi-point charge, or pastors who could find themselves for various reasons having to do a multi-point charge that you can share that would help them to hopefully not fall into some of the traps that will help lead them to feel like they sort of are losing their way in ministry?
Let's see. I would say, for one thing, I wouldn't romanticize a charge. I've been on both sides of it. I've been in the management where you brought charges together and then you romanticized how it was going to have a sweeping change on the area, and then that didn't come and people were disappointed. The fact is, most of our charges are created for economic packages of pastors. It's an economic necessity kind of thing. But on the other hand, what I don't want to do is necessarily accept it as the last stages. Most of the participants in a charge have been around a long, long time as a small church, and they could be around a lot longer too. So what I would want to say to the churches of the small church, you know what? You got a great story. I want to hear it. I want to learn it. And then we want to talk about how we're going to develop it while I'm here. And your story, your community, your context, your particular gifts, I want to dwell on that. But also don't want to miss the opportunity that as you become as strong as you can be, you might have assets that you could share with the other people in the charge, and that there are things that we could do or ministries that we could share, and we could have special access to one another that we couldn't do otherwise. We can get enough youth together in these five churches that we can take some trips together and do mission projects together. One particular church has something going really good, but if the other four of us jumped in there, it could be spectacular. I don't want to miss the opportunity, but I want to use it from the angle of not trying to imagine that there's this one great big new organism called the Charge. There are these churches. They're in facsimile. They are the same vicinity. They share the same leader, pastoral leader. And there are new opportunities for them to do some cooperation, even as they develop as local congregations.
Great. Thank you, Lou. I want to now hone in more on your last book, which in some ways continues this conversation, Small on Purpose. And you begin by talking about moving beyond statistics, like attendance, giving, et cetera, that often dominate small church conversations. And my question is, how can pastors move beyond these statistics when they get pressure, no matter what denomination you're in, you get pressure from above to really focus on these things? So how can you not get overwhelmed sort of by the conversation of you know, these sort of measurements that you usually are coming from the top down?
Well, the first thing I want to say is, you know, the measurements really are not as hard and fast as you might think sometimes. And one of the issues, I've never been against measuring. I just want to have the right measurements. And the measuring that we use, sometimes helpful and not so helpful. You know, here's one thing I don't know what to do with now, and that is that the norm seems to be, you know, I'll come to church once or twice a month, as opposed to, you know, three out of four Sundays or something like that. And right now we don't have metrics that show that, at least the ones that are applied in my conference. They want to know what your average worship attendance is. The metrics haven't caught up with the reality yet. So I've never been against you know, the numbers per se. They're serious. If you haven't baptized anybody in 2 or 3 years, if nobody's joining Confession of Faith, then you have to question the vitality of your congregation. And I do that. But the other side of it is, I don't want to become so oppressed by the numbers that I lose my confidence to go forward and keep trying, doing the best I can. The decline in the mainline, it really is not necessarily in the small congregations. It's at a bigger level. That's where you see the really huge numbers. A lot of small churches have been relatively stable for decades, and even in some instances, centuries. And they go up a little, they go down a little, but they're still there. So I'm not against the metrics. I just want to say that we always have to work to find metrics that really are significant. And I don't know what the significant ones are these days with worship attendance. I don't know how to get that. You know, that might be something the Lewis Center works on too. What are the relevant metrics for worship attendance? Most of the time that small churches existed, they didn't even keep attendance on worship. And that's an interesting telling remark. Maybe sometimes you shouldn't look at your numbers. You should just go forth.
Good. That's helpful. You also talk in the book about weaving the stories of the people into the sermon, and you give the example of sort of the birth narratives from the Bible, and you use it as an opportunity to use baby pictures from parishioners as part of your sermons. Can you share more about this methodology and the preparation it takes to weave stories together in this manner?
When from my time at Wesley and teaching various pastors, I've always been fascinated by the call response preaching of the Black church. And it's vital. If you're in the service, you just hear it. But I know from one of my students that that call response type of preaching occurred in other churches. I can remember in my ministry the last, what we called the Amen Charlie. And most older pastors can remember that person whose designated role was to say amen and talk while the pastor talked. I don't know that I can just teach people to talk back to me. I've tried that. I've known some pastors that have tried the conversational type sermons. They usually don't go very far. It just doesn't work. But my question is, are there larger conversations I can have with the congregation that will pull them into the content of my sermons then? And so, I did the narrative one, and I had them bring in baby pictures. And so each Sunday I would show some baby pictures, and I wouldn't tell them who it was. Can you guess who this is? And then I would reveal who it was. And that was a great thing. And then I'd launch into narrative stories from Scripture and that kind of thing. The baseball, first time I did the baseball thing, I just asked them, what do you know? What do you hear? What do you watch? And people came, so to speak, out of the woodwork with engagement. I'm near Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. We have the Senators. That's a AA farm club of the Washington Nationals. And I didn't realize it, but when I announced the baseball thing, a lady came forward and said her husband used to be broadcaster for the Nationals, and they hosted Senator players in their home. So she knew people like Ryan Zimmerman, and she had stories of them in the days before they went down to the Nationals. She had stories to tell. One of the best was a lady whose sister played in the League of Their Own movie and was with the Georgia Peaches and had wonderful stories about that and had some artifacts from it, like the lady with the Nationals had some bobbleheads of players. And it just... it brought all sorts of things out. I do a series on Broadway and find out that certain persons have certain interests in Broadway and had billboards and that kind of thing. What I figured out I have to do, I need to create the conversation before we get down to the sermon series. Create what would really be a good conversation. Then channel that into a sermon series and then use what the people say. And in fact, that can lead to things that are active in the congregation. In the baseball one, I found a guy who had been an umpire, kept his padding that they used in the old days in his mask, had him come up and make a couple of calls. That an umpire making a loud call out is a great way to start a sermon. It just gets the attention of people, and they're with you. So I want a call response environment when I preach in a small church. I think it's easier to do in a small church. I don't know if you could pull that off in a larger one, but that's not where I'm at. I'm in a setting that it would allow you to engage people and talk back and forth before, during, and after the sermon. And that's what I like in a small church preaching.
And Lou, you also talk in the book about these three categories of witnessing that I found really helpful: providential healing and biblical echo. And you We started our conversation with one of the books you were reading, sort of talking about providential, but can you say a little bit more about these categories and ideas for congregations and ways that people can actually sort of embody these and live them out to help them witness better?
Well, as I listen to people talk, almost everybody uses a category of I saw God in that, or it was a God thing. And if I had to theologize on it, they're basically saying they saw some divine intervention in a certain situation. God was there. And so I coached them in people who wouldn't necessarily think they have a witness. They do have a witness to providence, and so you need to share it. It's not necessarily a witness of victory all the time. Sometimes it's a witness of how God was with them in, say, the cancer that didn't go away. Or sometimes it's how I lost this work, but it opened this job, but it opened this door kind of thing. So in a small church, you're close enough to individuals, you can listen for this. And when you hear it, I ask them if they would help build up the faith of the congregation by sharing it. And oftentimes, I promise and I keep it, I stand beside them. I'm right there. If they tell them not to worry, if you start to cry, that's okay. We'll wait it out. We'll go on with the story and just share it in their lives. Basically, we're all trying to get through here with some grace and do it well. And anybody that can help us see the subtlety of God sometimes, the surprising nature of God sometimes, I think that builds up the people. They know I'm supposed to talk that way. They know I'm supposed to bring out those things. But they need to hear it from each other. People have such a sense of, at least in the congregations I serve, I don't want to come across as holier than thou. You know, who am I to be doing this kind of talk in public? But on the other hand, that's really what we need to hear. You know, God is present, how God is working, how God shows up.
Lou, as we get ready to sort of finish up here, can you sort of share, you talk about in the book, this powerful sort of image of a surrogate family, and that image really sort of has stuck with me in terms of this is one of the sort of advantages that small churches have, is that they really can embody being a family. Can you say a little bit about, one, why that image is so important, but I think the critical piece for me is how you can then avoid, though, as you know, sometimes our families become closed and we don't want to be open to other people, so that the value of it, of course, is when you're welcoming to everybody, how you can still be a surrogate family, but make sure you're not closing other people out of the family.
Sure. I think, first, I would say that these values can be accomplished in larger churches if they, you know, but it has to be done through small groups and everything. It's a natural setting in the small church. The small churches in the New Testament are like that. They're surrogate families. They're they actually break the patrilineal type of stereotype of families in Rome and in Judaism. What I found in, first off, it's before it even gets to the church, it's what society is at large, which is not the nuclear family now. It's grandparents raising grandchildren, couples that don't have children, young adults living at home, all sorts of people. And one of the things which I ask myself, why do you show up every week? Why are you here? And I am certain that some of it is the recognition of yourself as a person and your engagement with other people in family-like relationships, which is keeping up with one another's stories, sharing the really good stuff and sharing the really bad stuff. I've had an academic snobbery about joys and concerns that go on forever in a small church. I'm becoming a little more tolerant, not a lot, but a little more tolerant about those activities because I'm realizing what's going on there. There are people who have no other gathering where they're going to share those kind of intimate, happy, and sad moments, and there isn't the patience for it in other places. So I'm respecting that surrogate family building that went on before I ever showed up and will go on after I'm gone. Is the family going to be closed or is it open? A lot of that has to do with some of the key people, the matriarchs and patriarchs, and their character. I've grown up in a large family where some of the key players, they kept the gate open. They were always looking for that adoptee to bring in to the family. I know it can go both ways, and I know that a closed family can eventually die off, and that's kind of a you can see it, you can feel it. People can feel it when they come in and they try to break in, but they can't break in. So I do regard myself as the keeper of the health of the vitality of that family, that surrogate family. I am trained in, family systems. That was part of my education. So I know enough to blow the whistle when I see dysfunctional family behavior going on, and I want to do that. I can't create this family, but I can keep it a healthy family system, and part of pastoral leadership is doing that. If there's somebody who is triangulating people, if there's somebody that just has skewed communication, I need to jump in and to help there and keep the surrogate family healthy. So it is attractive.
Well, Lou, thank you. I think this has been really helpful. I have enjoyed the conversation, and we'll look forward to future conversations about small church with you.
Always good to talk with you, Doug. Thank you.
Leading Ideas Talks has been brought to you by Changes Congregations Are Facing Today. This ebook by Lovett H. Weems is an ideal conversation starter, especially for congregations evaluating their own ministries or engaging in planning for the future. Changes Congregations Are Facing Today is available at churchleadership.com/books. On our next episode of Leading Ideas Talks, Lewis Center Associate Director Ann Michael speaks with church consultant Susan Beaumont about how women leaders can learn to use power constructively in leadership relationships.
I think for many, many years, men have been mentored in their roles in ways that naturally lead them through the dynamics of how you use power in leadership relationships. And I think that women have not had that same kind of mentoring experience. And in many ways, women have learned to think of power as something bad to be avoided, something that has been used against them by oppressive leadership structures and something that they want to avoid. And in learning that lesson, that power is something to be avoided or something that's only used manipulatively, women, in fact, end up undermining their own influence efforts.
Leading Ideas Talks is available on iTunes, the Google Play Store, and Stitcher. Subscribe today. Thank you for joining us. And don't forget to subscribe free to Leading Ideas at churchleadership.com/leadingideas.